Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly, episode 64, recorded on April 11th, 2019. This is the geeky photo podcast where we dive into the news stories of the week in the photo industry and sometimes slightly beyond to find things of interest that we can really kind of dive into, you know, lift up the hood and tangle with all the engine stuff in a car. I'm not a mechanic. I'm a photographer, and I know photographer terminology and all that jargon is what we get into here. I'm your host, Don Kamarechka, and with me today, I always have a co-host. I think, and I gave it some thought, this is my favorite person living in Japan. And he's also a fellow Colorati and enjoys printing, uses a high megapixel camera. And I want to talk to you about that a little bit. With me today is Martin Bailey. Martin, how are you?
I'm very good. Thank you, Don. It's great to be back on your show.
Well, it's always great to have you. You know, when we get into the weeds on some topics, sometimes I worry that we'll never get out. we can really dive right. Like, it's like that Alice in Wonderland down the rabbit hole kind of thing. And I guess that's what people like about this podcast. So thanks for bringing that to the audience.
Not at all. You're welcome. It's always a pleasure to be here.
So what have you been up to lately?
I'm actually not necessarily directly photography related. I've just come back from my 3 Japan winter tours, which were great. That was, of course, 24/7 photography for 12 days, and absolutely wonderful. And I used the EOS R, a slightly lower resolution camera, for all 3 of those. So
I want to ask you about those differences once we're past the intro, because I have a couple of, I want to pick your brain, but your tours.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that it's mostly landscape work, landscape wildlife and that sort of outdoorsy stuff. Weather cooperates for you?
Most of the time, yes. My Japan winter tours, I do. The first one is landscape centric and the second 2 are wildlife. And for the landscape, a lot of the time we're in places where it really needs to snow to blank out the background and to make it really minimalist. And so we sometimes spend a few hours driving around in our big bus. We'll drive around waiting for it to snow or go into places where it doesn't quite matter that it isn't snowing or it's actually better that it's clear. But then when it snows, we head to a few locations where I want to do these minimalist shots. And so we depend on the weather, but so far, we always get what we need, and it may not always be in the shape that we need it, but I always end up giving the team a really productive 12 days.
And if you have a heavy snowfall, especially if you have a slightly longer shutter speed where you can't actually see the snow falling as individual flakes, it functions like fog in offering that minimalist background, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, even with a fast shutter speed, the background in some of the locations that you'll have a mountain range or a farm or a second stand of trees that are getting in the way, and they just disappear, and they leave the one stand of trees that you're hoping for to just sort of stand there and be what they are. But also, I mean, like, for example, there's one shot that I love doing. Well, a couple of the scenes where I recommend that the group uses like a 25th or a 30th of a second, because then you get these the snow is just streaking across. I mean, you're the snow guy, so that would sound strange if I said you're the snowman, because you're not. But the streaks across the trees make it almost look like a pencil drawing. You know, you've got the, when you get back, you've got
there's nothing. A Photoshop effect for that, although I'm sure it's not nearly as effective.
Yeah. Oh, it looks beautiful. I absolutely love the work that we do on that landscape trip. And because the second wildlife tour is getting so crowded, I'm thinking of switching in 2021. I'm thinking of switching to doing 2 landscapes, one at the beginning, the wildlife in the middle when it's not quite so crowded, and then go back to the landscape for the 3rd trip. Because the landscape trip's actually selling better than the wildlife one now anyway. So
very cool. And how many years have you been doing those? I know it's been at least 5 or 6.
Oh, it's been 12 years now. I started
for that specific trip. People are still coming around the world in droves to do it.
The landscape trip, I actually used to, in 2008, I started my first of these tours. So that was exactly, if you include both tours on each year. It's 12 times we've done them now. And on the first one, and for the first couple of years, I used to do the landscape and wildlife together. But people were gravitating towards the wildlife, and they really just wanted to do that. So I made it wildlife only and dropped the landscape aspect for about 5 years. But then people were started asking about it again, and I thought, you know what, in 8 and 9 years ago, I jumped in my car, got on a ferry for 24 hours up to Hokkaido, and I drove literally around the whole island. And during that time, I found a bunch of great hotels and great locations and built a new tour on that I kicked off, I think, in 2013 or 14. So you're right, about 5 years, 5 or 6 years ago. And that was the new version of the landscape tour. And it's actually turned into a very successful trip. And I really enjoy doing it. So
you've been doing it for so long, and it's great to have an instructor that has been in an environment or knows the subject, even if it's in a new location, but knows the subject like the back of their hand. Yeah. To know exactly what scenarios to look out for, you know, what technical problems you might come across. And so Martin Bailey, you're the one to go to if you want to head to Japan for some winter workshops, which I'm envious of. I actually want to tag along to one of those at some point in the future. But In previous years, I know that you were shooting with the 50 megapixel EOS 5DS. Was it the R that you had before?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I had somebody ask me a question this past week, and they were thinking of jumping into the Lumix S system, the mirrorless full frame cameras from Panasonic. And I've had experience with both the S1 and the S1R, trying them out. And they were really trying to justify the S1R, which is a 47 megapixel body over the 24 megapixels of the S1. Mm-hmm. And I asked them, well, yeah, you've got to qualify. You have to have a need for these extra pixels. And so I asked, well, what do you typically do with your images? And well, I post them online I occasionally print. And okay, printing, that's an important one to consider. Mm-hmm. How big do you usually print? I said, 8x10, 11x14. My printer can do, 13 by 19. And I said, you don't need a 47 megapixel camera for that. Mm. And I know that you do a lot of printing and you've used high megapixel cameras and you've printed big. I can see big prints right behind you.
Yeah.
And I know you have a nice, if it's still there, a metallic canvas above your desk.
Yeah.
Yeah. So printing in terms of resolution, and do you find that you've lost anything in value for big prints when you go to the EOS R? How much is enough for somebody in terms of resolution?
Yeah, we're probably a couple of weeks early on giving you a definitive answer, because what I'm going to do, while I was in Hokkaido, I set up on my landscape trip, I set up a tripod and I shot one scene that I absolutely love that is full of detail with both cameras on a tripod. And I'm going to print them both out at 44 by 62. And without doing any, I mean, normally what I would do is use the on one's, what is it?
Perfect resize.
Perfect resize. I normally, if I'm going to be going over 150 to 200 DPI, I normally will run it through perfect resize just to upsize the image. I won't run that, and I will take a look. I'll probably do it twice, depending on how much media I want to use for this. I will probably do some tests first, and I'm going to try both ways, doing without any upsizing whatsoever, and see what that looks like, and then probably running both through perfect resize and seeing how they compare. Now, my guess at this point in time, looking at the quality of the images that are coming out of the, in my EOS R review, I actually put one of those before after sliders on one of the photos so that you can go through and see the between them. The difference in the quality of the images, the EOS R, if you just look at it, both of them at 100%. It's obviously smaller because you've got less pixels.
Right.
But the EOS R actually seems to me to be slightly sharper, possibly because it's mirrorless and the back of the lens is so much closer to the sensor. And so
easier to design higher quality optics when you don't have that large gap.
And,
right?
And that gap allows the light waves to spread out a little bit more. So you're really, you've got a camera that is designed for better quality images off the bat. So I'm thinking that they will probably be comparable. And I'm talking here at 44 by 62. If
I want to interject. That is above the size that 98% of anybody printing
exactly.
is going to go, right?
So I'm probably going to do the other one, the other size that I like and that a lot of people are more tend to be doing is things, like, as you just mentioned, like 13 by 19 or 24 by 36 is another popular sort of, because it's 24-inch printers are a little bit more common with photographers now than they were. So I'll probably do a few different tests and just see how they compare.
This sounds like an excellent episode of your podcast.
That's my plan. I've got a couple. I actually spoke with our mutual friend, Iberian X Perillo. I have a recording that I'm going to be editing from him today to hopefully release this week. Another thing I want to do straight off next week, and then the week after that. So 2 weeks from now, probably will be the subject of that podcast.
Cool. Let's talk about an image that is, it's our first story, and it's really low resolution in terms of what we'd be used to from a traditional photograph. Although, funny enough, like if you go to the actual, because it's a public domain image, you can download a version of it that is 7,416 pixels by 4,320 pixels as a 16-bit TIFF. That's an almost 200 megabyte file of this image. That is entirely useless. We're talking here about the very first photograph of a, or I shouldn't say photograph, very first image of a black hole. And this has been reported everywhere. It's not technically a photo, but I think it's going to qualify as our lead story. Researchers have been working on this for a very long time. The Event Horizon Telescope has just announced their efforts to take a photograph, again, in a air quotes term, of the black hole in a nearby galaxy, Messier 87. I shouldn't say it's nearby. It's in a different galaxy cluster. We're going to get into all those details. But Martin, what do you think about these results?
To me, it's phenomenal. It proves that Einstein's theory and everything that has been theorized over the last 100 years or so was true. I mean, we've been basing science fiction movies on black holes for years, and we had, you know, because of wobbling stars and all the various things that we
we've had math and we've had theories,
yeah,
and we've had this, math that backs up theories, but we haven't had anything tangible beyond that, right?
This absolutely it to me is one of my childhood dream photos, and I'll call it a photo. I mean, I know it's made from the radio telescope data, but you know what? It looks fine to me, and it's just I'm like a kid when this stuff comes on the TV. And of course, they're raving about it here because there was a Japanese team that had a big part in this whole thing. So they're very happy to see this news go out. But I mean, it's like they're using the, I'm not sure how it's being reported in other countries, but they're using the example that this telescope, what we're looking at is like staring at with a naked eye at a tennis ball on the moon. That's basically what we're seeing a photograph of here.
Yeah.
And
I think it's even more elaborate than that, because if you could imagine, it's not that you're staring at that tennis ball on the moon. Mm. It's like you're like a baseball pitcher pitching a fastball at that tennis ball at the moon, and you have 8 cameras positioned on that ball that are moving around like crazy. Yeah. You have to try to correlate all of the data from those little lens segments to build a picture of that tennis ball on the moon.
Yeah, I mean, the math behind this is absolutely, I don't pretend to it. I haven't even really looked into what happened here, but it's just incredible that they were able to do this. And to me, the biggest thing is just the proof that they exist, and that, and we can now, I think it's a, at one of those moments in human history that will define who we are.
I agree. And I think that this is this, unfortunately, it's a good thing, but this is only going to be a small stepping stone and will be forgotten when the next better image comes up. And it will happen. They were talking about it in the conferences. I was listening and they had some Q&As afterwards. And they want to add higher resolution. So instead of using, I think they used it was a 1.3 millimeter wavelengths. And they want to try this again with 0.8. And they want to add more radio telescopes on Earth and potentially one in orbit as well, if they can get the funding for that. And all of that will help build up more information. Now, talking about information, and this is where things kind of get geeky if we weren't there already. Each of the eight radio telescopes that participated in collecting data for this image recorded 350 terabytes of data of radio signal information. So you're left with like 2.8 petabytes of data that then has to be crunched into an image that has the resolution of a Game Boy camera photograph. And so, I mean, you're taking so much to get so little as an end result. And I'm sure that there's been the Instagram crowd that was like, well, this is a blurry blob. I mean, I can take that with my finger half over my camera. Well, that's not the point. It's not what it looks like. It's what it represents, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Proof that they exist. It's proof that they exist. And that, to me, I mean, it was obviously there's math behind it. It's been pulled together from, like you say, a huge amount of data. But just the fact it's not so much the beauty of the photograph. And I think as a photograph, it's got a certain amount of merit. But if you take that, remove that from the way we think about this, it just represents so much for the human race, I think.
Before they started working on this project, like 5 years before the wheels were in motion, this was conceived of being impossible. And now here we are and it exists. And so, I mean, that's wonderful. I looked into some of the details. I was just so curious. You know, there's different classes of black holes. Some people say that there's micro black holes and all three different sizes to what we classify as a supermassive black hole. And while technically the black hole in the middle of the Milky Way galaxy is a supermassive black hole, I mean, I was thinking, why don't you focus on that one? Because it seems a little closer. The M87 galaxy's central supermassive black hole is so much bigger than our own that in the sky, from our observations, they would appear about the same size. That also, you know, I'm not the scientist, and I'm just trying to come to some conclusions in my head here. Why would you then choose the further away one? Because there's got to be something extra happening there, and it could be the accretion disk. I mean, that's all we're seeing in this image. In the middle, you have a dark blob. That's your black hole, and the accretion disk is all the matter that is spiraling at phenomenally ridiculous, even by astronomical terms, speeds and energies. I found in one article, although it's not, I can't find it again to corroborate, but they said that the intensity of the light of that was brighter than the like all of the stars in the galaxy combined. And that's a huge feat. And I kind of have a hard time believing it. But it's ridiculously bright. And I think that the larger the black hole, the brighter that accretion disk would be, which would have made it a more applicable target for everybody to focus their radio telescopes on. And voila, 200 international astronomers have been able to create. And I actually downloaded the 180 megabyte super resolution TIFF file. It's beautifully smooth.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure that every pixel of that was part of the computational input. It's just the resolution for the data doesn't resolve into pixelized detail. Yeah, and we often say in the photographic world that we're after good pixels, not more pixels. And I think you were seeing exactly that with the EOS R to the 5DSR comparison, is that, yes, you can have more pixels. And in some cases, you know, if you're in studio settings at your lowest ISO, you've got good light, everything is lining up perfect, then more pixels can be better than fewer. But if you want flexibility, if you want to move that ISO up a few notches, if dynamic range isn't a huge, a concern to you, then, you know, you can get away with a lot less from even an older generation camera. You don't have to stay completely on the bleeding edge of technology. And I've used old cameras, and I've used non-flagship cameras just to take great images and say, you know what? Yeah, you don't need to spend $3,000 to $5,000 on a camera body and lens and system to get yourself going. You can do it with a fraction of that. Mm. If you have a need for more, you need more. And I really hope that these guys, they get more radio telescopes and they do another run of this.
I'm sure they will.
The Max Planck Institute of Technology is where they had a supercomputer that correlated all of the data from the different telescopes to create this image. And I know that those supercomputers with the latest technology coming up in various different degrees are only going to get better and faster as well. So hooray for science.
Yep.
And, this is almost one that I want to set as my desktop wallpapers. There we go.
just to go back briefly on what you just said about the high resolution cameras, the just so that people understand that the 5DSR was actually a really, well, it still is. I mean, I've still got my two bodies, although I am thinking of selling one now for a second DSR. But they actually are still very, very good at high ISOs as well.
Yeah, but I used them for astrophotography. I had borrowed one from Canon for a while, and I tested it out doing star trails and night sky stuff, and it performed quite admirably.
I have some of my best work from the last four years or so is like 6400 ISO, pretty much in the dark. But because I was exposing to the right and doing everything to make exposure wise to overcome that, the ISO actually becomes the least problem that you have to deal with.
Then it's the photographer that's making the advantage, not the camera.
That's part of our job as photographers. We should understand the technical side of this stuff to bring out the most in our tools.
The EOS 5DSR is an older camera now. I mean, it's been out for a number of years. Mm. And so everything else is newer generation. You've got product cycles and everything else it's still good. And I'm sure Canon is going to come up with a camera that will beat it in resolution. They've got sensors in the works at the very least, 100 megapixels plus. But, you know, if I compare the 47 megapixels of the S1R versus the 5DSR, the S1R runs circles around it.
And
I was doing some studio stuff where I was doing ultraviolet fluorescence, and I was thinking, okay, well, let's try to kick this up to ISO 1600. Well, that looks fantastic. That's 3200. That looks great too. 64. We're laughing. Yeah. I even did some shots with the camera on a pole with the kit lens on it, so I could hold it up and photograph an art exhibition that I have at a local museum, sort of from a bird's eye perspective without going and grabbing a ladder. I just used my tripod for that above my head. But you have to be pretty stable, and I'm not when my camera is 6 feet above me dangling around this pole as I'm trying to hold it. And so I cranked that up to ISO 25,600. Completely usable, no questions. You might want to apply a tad of noise reduction in post-processing.
Yeah, yeah.
But the detail was all there. We're spoiled today, Martin.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. I have some images with the EOS R. The EOS R is 30 megapixels, and it's actually the same sensor. This is one of the negative things that people have been panning the EOS R for. It's the same sensor as the 5D Mark IV, which is only about a year younger than the 5DSR. But they used pretty much the same sensor. And it is about 1.5 stops or so better with regards to ISO, what I call ISO performance,
when you say ISO performance, is that like when you're at higher ISOs or the base levels for dynamic range?
The high ISOs. So if I can go to 6400 on the 5DSR, and as long as I'm exposing correctly, I can get a pretty much no grain in a 6400 ISO image. But on the EOS R, I can go a full stop. I went to 12,800, and I was getting images that were even slightly better than 6400 on the 5DS. So I'm thinking that it's probably a stop to a stop and a third or so, maybe.
Now, it's all subjective, right? I mean, everybody's going to look at the data, you know, shooting different subjects in different scenarios and find different uses for their images. But I trust your opinion on this, Martin. So that's awesome, especially for the same sensor. It means that they might have made some slight modifications to the analog to digital converter on the sensor or the way that that signal is then processed, because I think it has a new a processor before it actually gets to the file on the memory card. So there's improvements to be had all around.
Yeah, but I'm comparing the 5DSR to this. You know, the sensor is the same as the 5D Mark IV. So it's not apples to apples, but yeah, there's definitely more. The computational stuff that's going on around it is going to be updated. And I'm very happy with the EOS R. Like I say, I'm going to sell one of my 5DSRs and get a second EOS R, and I'll be going to Namibia in a few months just with
Why don't you think about putting one of those cameras to get converted to infrared or something like that? I don't know if you've experimented with that at all. That would be a lot of fun, especially in Namibia.
You know, the way I work, and a lot of the time I'm out in the field with guests of my tours, I probably would be better off using, because I have to put the money from one camera to the next. I get a good resale value here in Tokyo.
Right.
And so for me, I mean, the main reason is financial. I can probably get an EOS R without paying any extra money just on what I get back for my 5DSR. So if I sell it now before the next version is out, I'll get enough to warrant the switching the bodies, because it won't really cost me anything.
Well, that means I should get my butt in gear and sell my 1DX that's converted to full spectrum photography and my 1DX Mark II because, I mean, I still have them and they're great cameras, but I'm not using them anymore they're only getting less valuable. So,
yeah. It depends on what's important to you. And I mean, at the moment, although I'd like to do some infrared photography, I don't think that time would really allow for it. And so I have this little policy that if I don't use a bit of gear for 1 year, it goes. And I'm almost at that point with my 5DSRs. So it's time to change.
Martin, you should see, I've got a table in my studio that is just covered with esoteric gadgets and eccentricities in the photographic world, stuff that I might have used once. I didn't pay a lot for it, but I might find another use for again in the future.
Yeah,
and so there it sits, waiting for that possible future adventure. And it sits with 100 other doodads and knickknacks and gadgets. But if we talk about those types of gadgets, I mean, some of them are flashes and lights. I mean, I use my ultraviolet flashes occasionally when the mood suits. And I've got just a ton of odd lighting gear. I went through an aunt of mine gave me a bag of old photo gear recently, and in there was a continuous photo light, tiny compact little unit. And I looked at the rating on the bulb, and it said 650 watts, and the bulb was the size of my thumb, like the first joint of the tiniest little thing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I got to plug this in and see if it works. And it did. And then the dust all around it started to burn because it had been sitting around for a while, made an awful smell.
Yeah.
But I actually used that for some photo reproduction purposes, because it was just a really nice, high quality, full spectrum light, not LEDs or anything. And I used it to use the S1R, the Lumix S1R, in its high resolution mode as a continuous light to digitize some old photographs and some covers of old newspapers and things that don't really need that resolution, but sure, let's throw it at it just to see what happens. And it worked great. And now I don't know how old that thing was. It's got to be at least 50 years old. And I just got a giggle about plugging it in and unplugging it as soon as the exposure ends, because if I didn't, I would burn my hand holding this thing, leaving it on for about 5 seconds. But we're talking about lighting, and the next story is a notice from Godox to retailers stating that we did not steal Profoto's designs. And this is a Petapixel article. It's been reported on DP Review and F-Stoppers and pretty much everywhere else. But it's been in the news a little, but we haven't covered it at all on this podcast, that Profoto came out with a very cool circular flash, the A1. And shortly thereafter, Godox, another less expensive manufacturer, came out with a flash that also had a circular flash head. And Profoto was like, hey, you stole that from us. You know, you got to stop doing what you're doing. We're going to sue you and everything else that you could complain about and threaten because it has a circular flash head. I think that's kind of where the similarity ends, though, to be honest with you. I look at these two flashes. And the body design, the menu system, everything about them just screams entirely different designs whatsoever. What gets me is that why haven't we had circular flash heads before now? I mean, it seems like a transition that should have happened even a decade ago, right?
Yeah, I mean, I actually use... I mean, I know this is audio, so waste of time showing this, but I've actually got a Profoto studio light on a stand to my left here. And I have four of them, and these are like plug-in studio lights, and they're all round, you know. So it, like, in the studio lighting arena, they've been round, especially from Profoto, but I think most manufacturers probably are. They are round, and it's a beautiful shape for the light source. Although I do throw them into soft boxes and then have the light come through the soft box. But yeah, I mean, round makes so much sense. Our main natural light source, the sun, is round. So why not have the light sources?
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. No, it makes so much more sense. And I really like the trend. I would love the Profoto and probably the V1. From Godox, you know, they both look like great flashes, but they do look different enough that, you know, just the shape, I mean, round, is that enough to, there's probably other similarities, and I'm sure that if Profoto really do feel that Godox have infringed on a patent that they don't have yet, then they'll probably be going to court and they'll battle it out. But I don't think that the similarities are great enough that, that it's going to really result in Profoto being able to shut Godox down on this one.
And we're not lawyers. At least I'm not. No, I'm assuming you're not.
I'm not.
but you know, every camera manufacturer that has been making rectangular speed lights, they've all been able to work that out without having any major legal repercussions to my knowledge, or at least none that I can think of right now. They all kind of live in that ecosystem. And I think it's just the fact that there was a round flash head involved, and there might be a patent for that in this particular format. But everything else, from the body design to the menus and the button layout, everything else is not the same. You look at the lens fiasco with Meyer Optic, where one of their lenses was exactly the same as a Chinese manufacturer, except that the color of the paint on the barrel was different. And I mean, that's clearly and obviously, and it's come to light now that was a copy and it wasn't really manufactured by them. But this genuinely looks like a distinct product. We haven't talked about it until now, but I think the story's kind of coming to an end. I actually want to get my hands on the Godox V1 because I hear their equipment is great. I haven't owned any of their stuff. I have stuff from Young Nuo and KNF Concept and a lot of the other budget brand lighting sources. I've been meaning to get one of those Amazon Basics flashes just to test it out too, to see what that's all about. But this, especially if I'm doing my ultraviolet work, I'm taping circular filters onto a rectangular flash head. But in this case, I can get more bang for my buck, presumably, if all of the light is going to come out of the filter properly. So if anybody has been following this, I mean, I encourage you to take a look and see where this is going. But there's a bit of a Barbara Streisand effect here happening, because Profoto has been complaining so much about Godox that it has put the Godox flash in the news more.
Yeah.
And if you actually look at the statistics over time on Google Trends, the Profoto flash has been relatively flat, aside from a few spikes. But the Godox flash has been rising and rising, and it's now more popular in Google searches than the Profoto flash is. So, you know, self-fulfilling prophecy, maybe, in some ways here.
Yeah. You know, I mean, just taking a look, if I was to walk into a store and not understand any of this, just aesthetically, and if I was to pick both of these up, because I'm a Profoto user, I would probably go for the Profoto. But At more than
three times the price, though? Almost four times the price?
You know, that's the problem with me. I mean, if I think that something is going to be better or fit I'm very sort of, let's see. I mean, aesthetics to me is important. And I have to love the gear that I'm using from an aesthetics perspective as well. But yeah, I don't know. I will pay more for something if I think it's better. But in this case, I mean, I don't know. I haven't really looked at the specs, but the Godox is a very respectable and perhaps looking at the amount of control on the back, perhaps the better flash out of the two of these. So if it was, I would still go for the Godox because looking at the back menu, looks like you've got lots of great control. Aesthetically, I think the Pro Photo has the edge, you know, with the black LCD or whatever, you know, LED on the back, LCD. It's all, you know, to me, probably there's very little in it. Spec-wise, the Godox may even have the edge. So if that's the case, that may be the one I went for.
I just want to mention the prices that Profoto is charging $995. I'm assuming these prices are in the US for its A1 flash, but Godox for the V1 is $259. I can get four of those for a slight marginal increase over the Profoto version.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know for sure that the Godox is better than one quarter of the value of the Profoto.
Yeah,
now, if you need one really, really good flash and you want it to be absolutely the best, there's that law of diminishing returns. You know, you want 10% better performance, you pay 10 times as much in order to get it because that's the only way that you can get it. You want the best and there it is. Yeah. But you know that's kind of the difference that we see with computers too. You know, a lot of professional creatives will swear by Macs because the quality's there, the apps, it's designed for creators, and there's a certain air of prestige. Possibly, I've always been a PC user, and so I've built my own PCs for years, and I know exactly what parts go into them. And when something breaks, I know how to fix it, and I've had to fix them. But I get a lot more bang for my buck that way. And if you're using Adobe software like Photoshop, Lightroom, or any major software vendor, if you're talking about, you know, On1 or, well, I mean, not exclusive stuff like Apple has their Final Cut Pro that's only for the Macs, but a lot of pros are, you know, moving away from that platform in many cases too. The next story, if we can dig into that, if that was an appropriate segue, is building a photo editing computer on the cheap. And it kind of goes into what would be required if you wanted to build your own machine. Building your own computer means that you're going to have to be running Windows. Are you a Windows or a Mac OS X user, Martin?
So I was Windows. I did my first computer back in 94 was Windows. And then from 95, I used Mac in college and hated it because it was the old Mac that kept blowing up on me every few minutes. And then I was Windows from 97 through till, around 2010.
So you flip-flopped back and forth.
So for 13 years.
Here.
Yeah. And I also, my last Windows computer was one that I made myself. I bought the chassis and all of the parts and threw it together myself. So I've done that, and I really, from a geek perspective, I really enjoyed doing that. But then in 2010, or I think the end of 2010, when I left my old job working here in Tokyo for a Florida-based IT company, I decided that I called Adobe and asked if I could switch my license because I was still buying the Master Suite at that point. And they said, if you go to this page, sign this, we'll send you the Mac version, the Mac CDs instead. So I switched in 2010, so 9 years ago now, and I have been a Mac user. I'm sitting here with an iMac Pro. I've got two MacBook Pros, and I'm sort of sucking on the Mac for fanboy Kool-Aid or whatever they call it.
Well, and you pay for that, right? I mean,
absolutely.
The Apple name is really what you're buying because the hardware inside is going to be very familiar to what you could build as a PC.
Yes.
Now, I got to say that the Mac operating system, OS X, has a lot of really fun, powerful tools. I remember this was years ago, and I'm sure it's still the case, but you could set a function to a specific folder. When you dropped a file into that folder, based on the file extension on that folder, the operating system would take some action with it. And you could choose to do something like whether you you drop a TIFF file in there and it automatically generates a JPEG, or it makes an extra copy of it somewhere else, or it does something. Yeah. And that functionality I thought was really cool, and 99% of people don't know it's there. So yeah. It's not useful unless you find it useful, unless you know about it. Yeah. And on a PC, the operating system... there's lots under the hood that you could get into in the same way, and some are different, but it's just a way to access things. It's a way to open my web browser and to load up the stuff that we're chatting on right now. And some is built for one program or one platform, and some for another. But when you're looking at components, Apple usually releases a product class like the iMac or the iMac Pro, and you have a few different upgrade options within that. When you're ordering it, usually they're static, right? So can't change that once you've placed your order. 5 years go along, and let's swap out the processor. It's kind of soldered in there, or if it isn't, you have to do a massive disassembly that I don't wish on anybody. But on a PC, you could say, you want a better graphics card, and you built your computer 5 years ago, you want to give it a little extra oomph. Okay, well, newer technology exists now, just throw that in its place and take over. In terms of what a photographer needs, and I think we have to base this conversation around that. What a photographer could need, and it also goes back on that idea of high-resolution photography, because you need more processing power for that, especially if you're doing complex stuff like, star trails with 50-megapixel images or focus stacking with that kind of resolution as well. What would you think the lowest spec that you would ever go to in terms of RAM and storage stuff, and what you would kind of call the holy grail right now without breaking the bank?
I would probably want 32 gigs of RAM, at least 8 cores CPU, but probably more. The speed of the CPU is also important, but and depending on what was available, I would just go for the fastest CPU I could possibly get. But you also have to have the fast RAM, the speed of the RAM as well as the amount is important. A nice big graphics card, because a lot of like Photoshop and Lightroom and Capture One, these programs all use the memory on the graphics card to accelerate things as well. So lots of video RAM is important. I want probably a minimum of 2, hopefully 3 terabytes of internal storage. But if I also want to make sure that's SSD. So, at the moment, my iMac Pro has 2 gigabytes, 2 terabyte SSD for the main drive, and that is a little bit on the small side for a desktop computer, but because it's SSD, I'm happy enough with that. But you want plenty of, those are the main things, aren't they? The SSD that you put in there for your operating system, your RAM.
You
want
to remove the bottlenecks, right?
Yeah.
And so whatever the lowest common denominator is here, and sometimes it's storage if you're dealing with massive files, especially if you're shooting and editing 4K video. There's a lot of throughput between where that file is stored and how you're accessing it through the processor and what have you. When you mentioned CPUs, and you mentioned, more than 8 core might be great, just caveat emptor here. When you go to really high core counts, you get into the reduction of the speed of every one of them. And that you can buy, Intel announced like 56 core CPUs, AMD 64 core CPUs with like 128 threads. That we don't need because the speed of each and every one of those cores goes much, much lower in order to maintain a thermal threshold for these processors to survive properly. So when you go above a certain point where you know your software isn't going to use more than that number of cores, and having more than that number reduces the speed of each and every one of them, then you've gone too far. Yeah. And I think now that limit is around 10 to 12 cores. I would say 10. In my experience with Photoshop, I've never seen it use more than 8. It might use more in the future, and you want to have a little bit of headroom there. So I'd say look at a 10-core CPU. Something in that neighborhood would be ideal. Yeah. If you go for 32 gigabytes of RAM, make sure it's the fastest stuff that you can put in there, because RAM has different speeds as well. 64, if you've got the extra dollars. You mentioned graphics cards too, and that's important, because pretty much every program on the market has some GPU acceleration functionality to it. But you don't need to spend like $1,000 on a GPU. And the reason why is, while they have GPU compatibility, they all have to make that compatibility down to that lowest common denominator. They build it for the cheap cards because they are more popular. And having a GPU that has more texture mapping units and more stream processors and all of that, that doesn't necessarily help you, because all of that extra overhead isn't going to be used, because the software is only going to be using a smaller percentage of those. So using higher clock speeds, both in the GPU itself and the associated memory, would be more useful. So you might have to do a bit of research on that, but the flagship GPUs are made for gaming, and the games are tailored for them. Which I wish consumer software for image editing was N-core optimized. You give me this many stream processors, I'll use them all. You give me this many cores, I'll use every bit that you throw at me. Yeah. Some things are. Like when I'm encoding data in the Adobe Media Encoder, putting a little video together or something, it just, everything goes to the nines. It is just, hammering every bit of resource that it can take. And the same thing is true of when I run On1 Perfect Resize, which we mentioned earlier. It hammers the CPU. I have 24 CPU cores, and it just rides that all the way up to the highest possible level when it's, chugging those numbers. And you want software that does that. I was hoping that Adobe would jump in and do more of that when I built the system with all of these cores. And that was 6 years ago, and they have not done that. So, when you're trying to build a computer, and this is a great time to do it, I might wait until July, because in July, AMD is going to be announcing their Ryzen 2 platform. Ryzen 3, but the Zen 2 system with the Threadripper 3000 and their server processors, but even their consumer stuff, will hopefully all support PCI Express 4. And that is an important distinction than the PCI 3 standard that we're on right now, because it doubles the theoretical bandwidth that can run through that bus. And if we're talking about bottlenecks in the data on our SSDs specifically, or any other devices like our graphics card that can feed more information to those systems, then those CPUs with a compatible motherboard will support that. Your hardware will also have to, SSDs and everything else will have to be compatible, but at least building that system now and having hardware that could be replaced that will have a noticeable impact in the future years, that's the best future proofing I think you can get from a computer build.
Well, just looking at you just said right there that you built that your computer 6 years ago and you have 24 cores. I bought the iMac Pro last year, and I'm looking at my preference, the spec right now, and it's I've got 8-core CPU, and that was literally as many as I could afford. I was thinking I'd like 10, but it took me over budget, really. I mean, I spent more than a small car on this. It was like $12,000 for this computer, and I mean, I have 64 gigabytes of RAM and a 2 terabyte SSD. I've got 16 gigabytes of graphics memory, which is relative. That's a pretty hefty card right there. But yeah, I've still only got 8 cores, and I probably spent double what you spent to build your machine.
Actually, I spent, because mine is an older system, mind you, and it has 2 12-core Xeon processors. So there's 24 cores and 48 threads. This was at the same time when Apple was rolling out their Mac Pro, the trash can looking one.
Yeah, yeah.
And you could get it outfitted with 1 12-core CPU and 64 gigs of RAM and some workstation class graphics and all of that. If you put everything up to the highest slider point on the configuration thing, you would get to around $10,000. And that's what I paid for this machine. And I got exactly twice the number of cores because I got 2 of the CPUs. And I got exactly twice the amount of memory, 128 gigabytes of RAM. The exact same product cycle on a PC, I paid the same dollar value and got twice the hardware. Now, that's an outlier. That doesn't always have that much of a divide. But at the time, it was. So, I mean, you have to take it with a grain of salt. How much do you need versus how much do you want? Because those are always two different things. A want is a budget that, you know, is, you know, through the ceiling. I could build a $30,000 computer if I really wanted to.
Yeah, you know, I have, obviously for me, a lot of the time, needs are in air double quotes, you know, like want and need are almost synonymous for me. But I, what I do is, like I said earlier about the aesthetics of the flash, things like that. I now have just learned to really appreciate the aesthetics of the Apple computers, you know, and I will, I enjoy having this. I mean, the iMac Pro to me is the perfect desktop computer for me. It's got all of the power that I need. It's expensive, and I'm paying for that Apple branding for sure. But I just, you know, I like the way it looks sitting on my desk. And to me, aesthetics is a big part of, I mean, I like to just sit here and be surrounded by things that I like using. So for me, although it's throwing money away in some respects.
Oh, it's not if it's making you happier.
Well,
money can rarely make you happy. I think you might have defined one of the scenarios where it can.
Well, I mean, I never sat down on the sofa with a Windows-based laptop and just looked at it and caressed it. And but I'm afraid to say that I actually do that with my little MacBook Pros. And I just, I don't know. It's just, to me, there's something about the Apple aesthetic that I'm, like I say, I'm drinking the Kool-Aid, and although I completely understand, having come in from Windows and having built my own computers, you have a spot on point. And I definitely think that if raw power is what you need, then it's either going to cost you a kidney, if you want to do it on a Mac, or you can do it a lot less. You maybe just use, I don't know, half a lung or something if you're going to do it in. Now they're bad examples, but you know, I think the point that you have is solid. And if you don't care which system you're using, it's almost like whether you pick up a Sony or Panasonic, a Canon or a Nikon, you know, it really is all about.
It's all going to do the job, but everybody has brand loyalty, right? And you know, to some degree, I mean, brands come and go, and sometimes they come back. You see me trying to make a segue here to the next story. So, Martin, what is your thoughts on the current uses of the Yashica brand?
I really don't like this. I think it, I mean, not to the point where it's having me seething or losing sleep or anything. I don't care that much.
You're going to go rioting in the streets over this.
Right. I mean, there are much more important things to get angry about. But I, you know, with me living in Japan, and I mean, I'm a Japanese citizen now. So I love this country, and I hate the way the Yashica brand is being dragged through the dirt by this company.
We should state the title of the article, that Yashica, or the company that owns the Yashica brand, we have to state that it's not the original company anymore, reveals its own 35 millimeter film product following bizarre and confusing teasers. And this is following the Y35 disaster.
We spoke about that on the last show.
I don't even know how I could put it politely. Fluster cluck is the best way I think I might be able to phrase that.
I would have got that the other way around and made a mess of that.
So, okay. So they're trying to do something else with the brand that arguably requires less investment. I mean, to make a film canister with your logo on it and then load it up with a film emulsion that doesn't have to be your creation. I mean, you could buy bulk orders of film from whoever's doing the manufacturing line of it. And so we have a 35 millimeter film canister, branded Yashica, color prints, 400 ISO. Where does this start to go sour for you?
Well, it's just, I mean, it's like in the article that you'll link to, it shows the bad Photoshop work with the film, obviously not really coming out of that camera. And that's fine. You know, I mean, you have to mock this stuff up to a degree. But it's just, to me, that the point at which it starts to go sour is just the way the brand name keeps coming up in the news in these negative ways. You know, I mean, I hope that this company does actually make this film and it's good film. If that's how it turns out, I won't be disappointed at all. But I mean, one of my favorite old cameras is a Yashica. It's just the fact that the brand originally, they were never like a top brand, even here in Japan. I have a Yashica twin lens reflex camera, and they were basically back in the 70s and 80s when Japan was not defining the photo industry. It was copying it from other countries. They were basically a Rolly copy. And they were just a cheap alternative for the domestic market. But they became a little bit of they developed a cult following. And I still really enjoy dropping a roll of 120 film into my twin lens reflex Yashica and just having a walk. And it's the name that is kind of being dragged through the dirt that annoys me a little bit.
You see that with a lot of old film brands that are now defunct. I mean, Kodak is not really defunct per se, but they're one of the brands like Polaroid that have licensed their brand to be on all sorts of garbage. And that's my opinion. I mean, I haven't used all the stuff, but there was some confusion of like a Kodak cryptocurrency, which I think is still a thing. It might not be. I don't know where they went with that. A Kodak Bitcoin miner or some sort of cryptocurrency miner that was apparently unofficial but appeared at CES. Polaroid, there's Polaroid branded sunglass shops in Bulgaria when I go back there in the summertime with my wife on vacation, and we still see them there today. When I worked at The Source, which is an electronics store here in Canada, it was a derivative of Radio Shack. They're still around here. They had little Polaroid portable DVD players, and they were not a flagship product. I can say that much. They were cheap, and so we sold a couple of them here and there. But you looked at the quality of the LCD panel in there, and I don't think I saw a worst one in that kind of in that kind of a product. So it's not the only brand that has been dragged through the mud, but now the first time it's been resurrected, and it's just being stomped on. Or at least it was with the Y35, which lets everybody look at this very, very critically to see, okay, well, what could this be? There's no real announcement that says that they're developing their own emulsion. So this has to be something repackaged. And that's not uncommon in the industry. This happens quite often, actually. And so... how much work would it have been to mock up your own film canister? It looks like the film canisters themselves, if you had a Photoshop fail putting a film lead coming out the end of it, you would have had lots of other fails in the mock-up of something like this, where you have a cylinder and they're fading out of focus in the background. You could see some very wonderful fail moments on that. Somebody in the comments on this article, and I haven't been able to justify this, but they said that the DX code that can be seen on the film canister in the background is not for ISO 400. I mean, if you really get into the weeds on that type of stuff, well, yeah, maybe it is a mock-up and it's a failure, or maybe they just put their own label onto something that was from something else of a different ISO setting, and it's still going to be a mock-up. I don't know where I stand on this. I hope it's good. Like you said, I hope that this is a success for them. but the way they've treated the brand so far, I wish some benevolent philanthropist came in and just bought out the controlling rights on this and did something good with it. Maybe they will, but their track record currently says otherwise.
Yeah. No, I think that they really need to be a little bit more careful. It takes a long time to build trust, and it takes like a few stupid errors to lose it. And I think that these guys are making those errors. They've lost the trust. And once you lose trust, people will, like you say, start to try to find fault in everything you do. Yeah. And it's hard to get past that. They've got to do something stellar now to even get past that. And of course, on a personal note, my wife, who's Japanese, her name's Yoshiko, and it sounds very similar to Yashka. So it always annoys me on that way as well.
Oh, I didn't actually know your wife's name, so now I'll make a reference to that, and I will mispronounce Yashika to your wife's name whenever I'm talking to you and confuse the heck out of you.
Well, my aunt in England does that all the time. She calls her Yashika, so so it drives me mad.
All right. Well, maybe I'll do the same. Anyhow, Martin, before we get into the picks of the week, where can people find you online? I know you do a lot of photo workshops all throughout the year, not just in Japan, and you've got your own podcast as well.
Yeah, so everything is linked to martinbaileyphotography.com. I've actually just put a very cool new menu system in. I've transplanted the menu system from my theme for a one that has a much more greater amount of control. So you can now see thumbnails and things in the menu, and I'll be building that out. But everything is linked from the menu at the top page, with one caveat that I'm actually when we started the conversation, I said that you asked what I've been doing recently, and I said that it wasn't really directly photography related. And then I talked about my tours. But the thing that I'm actually doing this week is migrating I've got two virtual dedicated servers that are running my website and my link shortener and things like that. I'm now at the moment in the middle of migrating those to a single dedicated server. Like, I've got my own box now sitting there in California, and I'm migrating my sites over. So there may be a little bit of downtime over this next few days as I complete that. But
the next time I have you on, I'm going to pick your brain about that, because I might have to do the same thing myself.
Yeah. Well, I'm switching to InMotion Hosting. They're a huge company, but they have... So far, what I'm seeing is they have great support. The machine that I've been handed is very high spec for the price. I've moved because of price. I won't mention the name of the company I'm moving from, just because it's not really fair. I've been with them 10 years and I've been very happy with them. But I'm at the point where my website is consuming so much RAM that I need to upgrade. And just upgrading on a virtual dedicated server, which means I've got a container on another bigger server that shares its resources with other people, it will cost me $3,000 a year for that. And that, to me, for a virtual computer, seems like a lot of money. So I'm going to be getting a whole box to myself with 500 gigabytes of hard drive space, well, SSD space, instead of what I've got on my current one, which is like 24 or something like that. And also the RAM is gone to 16, and that would cost me $3,000 at my old company. So I'm moving, and it's one of those times when it's a little bit stressful because you have to do so much. But
so if you happen to go to martinbaileyphotography.com and it's not there, hold your
just
breath.
Just go back.
And go back again a little bit later.
Yeah, yeah. So it shouldn't be down for long, but if it is, please just revisit, because I haven't gone out of business or anything. I'm just trying to make things better.
All right. And we all appreciate that. Let's go into the picks, because this is where we get to recommend something to the audience. And mine is something that I've been using a lot lately. When I was doing my snowflake series through the winter, and I just did a whole edit of images for a client of mine, their image is not mine. And I found myself constantly going back to On1 Photo RAW, sometimes not as the original RAW processor, because sometimes I'm doing weird infrared and ultraviolet strangeness. But in every step of the way, I'd always go back there to at least use some of their software, because you can use it as a starting point, or you can use it as a plugin from Photoshop. And I've been using it as both. I find that some of the controls, specifically, I've disliked what Adobe has done with their highlight slider. If I move the highlight slider on Lightroom or Camera Raw, it takes everything even lower than midtones and adjusts it. When I just want to recover the stuff that is slightly overexposed, but leave everything else alone. And the clarity slider and dehaze slider end up being really grungy. You can control that in some ways, but in certain images, it's just not viable. But in On One Photo Raw, I found their highlight slider to be really, really fine-tuned to just take down that overexposedness. That's not a term, but it is now. of those highlights, just to bring that back down from that pure white. And the structure slider I have found remarkable. What I'll sometimes do is, depending on where I started the image, if I started it in Photoshop, I'll typically keep on there. I'll send a version of the image to On One Photo Raw, like crank the structure slider and some other things in there, and then paint that in with an adjustment brush. And I'll have the adjustment brush on that extra layer. So I've got that adjustment layer, and I will use the dodge and burn tool. So I will dodge the shadows at 100% on that black layer, on a mask, I should say. And so that mask then slowly brightens up, revealing those effects where they are most appropriate. Or I can do the same thing in On One if I was starting there to begin with. And there's a really fun kind of synergy between these different software elements that I'm glad that I'm exploring right now. If you haven't played with On One Photo Raw, and you don't want to make it your primary resource, at least know that it can add to your workflow or to the productivity and the output of your workflow by just giving it a try. And I'm sure they've got free trials. I have worked with them in the past, and they've sponsored me on something, so I should state that. But I've fell in love with their software, and I've used, as you mentioned, Perfect Resize far before any sponsorship or partnership, and that's why I've been working with them as well. So check them out. They're doing a lot of really revolutionary stuff over there in Oregon, in California, or where are they based out of? Portland, I think. So. Yeah. Yeah, check them out and tell them I sent you. Martin, how about you? Stuff.
You know, I was trying to recall what I used as my pick the last time we spoke, but even if it was what I'm about to say again, I've got better information now. So I might have done ProGrade Digital memory cards as
my... I don't think you did.
Okay, in that case, that's good, because they are making really good memory cards.
These are the former Lexar guys, right?
They are. So it's a few of the people that were at Lexar before it was sold off have formed a new company, ProGrade Digital. They're at ProGradeDigital.com. Don't put the www on the front, because then this website is not private, because they're not switching that across properly. But it's their cards. They make two grades of cards. They make a gold and a platinum card. I've used both, and to give you full disclosure, they actually sent me a couple of their cards to try over my winter tour season, and I used both. The gold is 200 megabits per second, and the platinum is 250 megabits per second. On an 8 frames per second camera, obviously my EOS R, which is the first camera that I've had that actually uses SDSX cards as the main card. I've used compact flash for years, and ProGrade don't actually make compact flash. They make the fast CF cards. CF. So I tried them in the EOS R, and on an 8 frames per second camera with the platinum cards, it can fire away almost continuously at 8 frames per second. With their gold, their slightly slower card, it drops to 7.5 frames per second. But that's all. So it's if you don't need the full 8 frames per second, then either is fine. And I did, though, even though they sent me the first two cards, to make sure that I had enough of this stuff for my tours, I went out and bought a second pro-grade digital platinum card. And this is something that I've not seen any of the memory card companies do yet, and I'm really happy about, is that they're trying to get pricing parity worldwide. So all of the other companies, you know, if you live in the US, then you don't care about this at all. and so it doesn't matter. But if you live outside of the US, you'll know that SanDisk and Lexar and a lot of the companies, the big memory card companies, have historically always charged at least 20, 30, sometimes almost 100% more, double price for their cards when you buy them outside of the US.
And the UK gets hosed more than anybody else on this.
Oh, the UK, Australia, Australia is a long way away, but geez, if you send a box over, you split it between a few thousand cards, it's not a lot of money to. So it's all just a marketing ploy. And these guys have historically taken, they've taken the Mickey, whatever you say. Anyone outside of the US, they have hosed them, and it's over, because ProGrade Digital, I can buy one of these cards here in Japan for exactly the same price as I can buy it in the US, and they're opening stores in lots of other countries. I mentioned earlier that I have another thing planned that I'm going to be talking about next week. It's a review of the ProGrade Digital cards. And I'll mention in there the countries that they're now, you can buy them on Amazon in all of these countries, and they're all going on sale, top grade cards for the same price that you can buy them in the US. And that is a breath of fresh air for anyone that's been buying memory cards outside of the US for the last 10, 20 years.
Well, I've been buying memory cards from the US because the prices are, they'll ship them to me. And with the conversion and the duty and the shipping and everything else, it's still cheaper to buy them from the US, so long as they'll ship them to you. And in some countries, I'm sure they won't. So,
and that, for Japan, they, SanDisk, if I tried to buy a card on Amazon from SanDisk, I would get the message that you cannot buy this card from your geographical location.
I've gotten that too for some things.
I found a way of sneaking through back doors, and I actually bought a SanDisk card from Amazon and had them ship it to Japan. But when that card broke, the only card I've ever had fail on me, two winters ago now, or maybe last winter, two winters ago, it broke. One of my 256 gigabyte SanDisk card failed on me. Turns out that it had developed a fault, and they asked me where I bought it from. And I said, I got it from Amazon.com. And they said, no, you can't buy them in Japan from Amazon.com. And I showed them a PDF copy of my receipt that shows that I did. So they replaced it. But they were complaining that I said, look, I don't care how, I did this. I bought it legitimately from Amazon.com, so you need to honor that. And they did. But these guys have taken away that necessity, because you can buy it on your local Amazon all around the world for the same price that you can buy it in the US. And the other thing that I should mention, sorry for harping on about this.
No, I'm listening with bated breath here.
Well, they have these, what they call them, workflow readers, and they're actually just obviously card readers. But they have one that they don't make CF cards per se, but they make a card reader that is for SD and CF cards, and it's Thunderbolt. It's USB-C Gen 2. So these things, you can actually. I haven't tested this yet. I'm going to include this in my review. But apparently you can transfer data from the CF and the SD card at the same time without losing any speed. So if you shoot both, that's a big merit. But these things are great. And these, apparently they're having problems keeping up with production because they're now so popular. But the ProGrade digital card, the card readers, are absolutely amazing as well. So I'm really happy with this company. I'm pleased that I'm now getting involved with them to a degree.
I'm so glad to hear this from you, Martin, because I was cautious on the brand because it's a new brand, right? In a memory card industry, you want to have a reputation to back up what you're buying because you don't want to have a card fail on you.
Exactly.
But But to have your glowing review, I'm going to have to look at them as a possible vendor for my next cards. Yeah. I don't know if they have any plans to produce CF Express cards. I don't know if anybody has announced a major association with that. That's going to be the next revision of the XQD cards that uses the non-volatile memory express protocol.
They do have it.
They do have it.
I'm looking here. It's got in their products menu, it has CF Express 1.0 memory card listed.
Oh boy, I'm going to have to look at that because that will be backwards compatible with firmware updates to any camera manufacturer that wishes to offer them to XQD memory card slots. It's just a change of the protocol and a firmware update can afford that. So, interesting times in the memory card world. I've always been a SanDisk fan, but lately I bought with my own money one from Panasonic. They're one of my sponsors, but I paid full price for one of their SD cards. And I'm using a Sony XQD card right now, but I have no brand loyalty anymore. SanDisk is kind of, well, they're just another brand at this point. I've been hearing stuff failing and just like you mentioned. All right, pro grade. I'm going to take a serious look.
I'm looking at these. They've got a 650 gigabyte card and a 325 gigabyte card, and they're rated at 1600 megabits per second. So.
It's either
megabit or megabyte. Normally it's megabit, but it could be megabytes.
That's always a gray area, but that's an entirely different discussion that I think we're out of time for at this point.
Absolutely.
At this time, Martin, thank you so much for being on the show. We've already told people where you can be found at martinbaileyphotography.com. And for the show notes for this, you can find everything, all the links to what we talked about at photogeekweekly.com. You can find me personally at doncom.ca. That's donkom.ca. But if you're still listening, you shouldn't be, because it's time to get out and shoot.